This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. We are awaiting President Bush's Saturday morning radio address. It should begin in about a minute and a half or more. Dan Shore joins me in the studio. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott.
President Bush is at the White House again this weekend. Spent a couple of days at Camp David earlier this week. Met with British Prime Minister Tony Blair, discussing the prosecution and progress of the war so far and its aftermath. We're 10 days into the events that began with, of course, that bombing in Baghdad that occurred in the afternoon, the middle of the night, early morning, actually, just before dawn in Baghdad. What do you feel the president has to express at this moment?
Well, the president is now having to express the idea that he's on track. He used the phrase on track in his speech yesterday because the questions are arising, especially when you have one of his generals having said that maybe it's going to slow up because we don't have all the ground forces we need. And the president needs to reestablish that something is happening in a way that he expected and wanted to happen, and that is this phrase, we're on track.
Now, and I should, by the way, say that I misspoke. The president's address will begin at 6 minutes after. I beg your pardon. Let me ask you about domestic opinion here in the United States, because Prime Minister Blair has been making one appearance after another, did an appearance with six housewives in London who are opposed to the war, certainly has been speaking in Commons every week. We have a different system. Public support, according to the opinion polls, for President Bush's prosecution of the war is high.
Very high. As a matter of fact, the latest poll by Washington Post ABC shows that nearly three-quarters of Americans are in support of the war, in support of changing the regime in Baghdad, even though many believe that there will be significant American casualties. In some ways, the American public seems to be ahead of its government. For example, when they decided to cut the proposed tax cut in half, the American public said, right on. Their willingness to sacrifice is in some ways ahead of the administration's calls for sacrifice.
And while we have the chance, I want to ask you what your impression been so far, I know 10 days into this experience, with the provision of embedded reporters. When I covered the Gulf War 11, 12 years ago, we complained about lack of access, although a lot of us who were with the troops just couldn't report instantaneously. Now the reporting is instantaneous. What effect do you think this is exerting on coverage?
Well, I think there are several, and it remains to be seen what the net effect of that will be. It's a whole new phenomenon in which you have reporters riding into battle with armored divisions and able to go on live from wherever they are. I think that it gives the Pentagon the opportunity to make an offer to the media that they find it very hard to refuse. And at the same time, some unexpected things can happen while you're on camera, so that we may be seeing a live on the battlefield effort that we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if mistakes happen, they're visible at the same time.
Mistakes they're visible. The companionship of the reporters and the divisions with are visible. That's true. It a little bit passes out of your hand when you put a live camera on and say, look.
Yeah. Let me ask you so far about the battle for opinion in the region in which the war is occurring. The United States and Britain have specifically, and the evidence of our reporters on the ground has been good, not targeting civilian areas. At the same time, inevitably civilian casualties, I don't want to say inevitably, civilian casualties, we must note, have been a result. The United States and Britain says many of them have apparently been caused by Iraqi anti-aircraft fire.
Maybe.
Falling back into the ground. This latest tragic incident of perhaps as many as 50 people killed in a marketplace, the cause of that has yet to be determined. Explain, if you will, how this is playing out as part of the war strategy.
Well, if the effort is to say that the Americans and the British and other allies are coming in as liberators, it certainly takes a little bit of the edge off liberation when you find a lot of civilians being killed. The remarkable thing is that there has not been a great deal of desertion, a great deal of flowers being pelted on the coming people. If the effort was to say, we're coming to save you, I don't think that has yet been established.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, what about the reports we've been getting that a lot of the Iraqi opposition we've been seeing, for example, in the Basra area, is the product of a kind of terrorism itself, of the paramilitaries?
Well, from all we know, and apparently we need some more facts, but from all we know, apparently people in the Basra area did attempt an uprising, even though an attempted uprising in 1991 didn't come off very well when the American troops went away. But they did. But apparently there are enough pro-Saddam forces, the Fedayeen and other irregulars, who are willing to threaten people and keep them from expressing their wishes for an uprising and leave it in a kind of a very strange state where nobody quite knows who's in charge in Basra.
Mm-hmm. And as the Prime Minister noted this week, perhaps Iraqi civilians in the south and in the north in particular are reluctant to credit that the U.S. and Britain are coming until they see physical evidence of the troops.
Well, based on what happened 12 years ago.
Okay. Scott Simon and Dan Shore in our studios. We are now awaiting President Bush's Saturday morning radio address, where we are told that he will speak to the American people from the presidential compound in Camp David, Maryland. The president should be speaking in just a few moments.
Good morning. This week I welcomed Prime Minister Tony Blair to Camp David, where we discussed the progress being made in the war to disarm Iraq, end the dictatorship, and liberate the Iraqi people. Thanks to our fighting forces, the regime that once terrorized all of Iraq now controls a small portion of that country. American and coalition troops have continued a steady advance and are now less than 50 miles from Baghdad. In recent days, we have cleared mines from the water and taken control of a key port city to allow humanitarian aid to begin flowing into the country. We have secured more than 600 oil wells and have begun putting out the few oil well fires set by the enemy. Our efforts to protect the wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people are paying off. And we have prevented the dictator from launching missiles from key sites in western Iraq. We are now fighting the most desperate units of the dictator's army. The fighting is fierce and we do not know its duration, yet we know the outcome of this battle. The Iraqi regime will be disarmed and removed from power. Iraq will be free. In the last week, the world has seen firsthand the cruel nature of a dying regime. In areas still under its control, the regime continues its rule by terror. Prisoners of war have been brutalized and executed. Iraqis who refuse to fight for the regime are being murdered. An Iraqi woman was hanged for waving at coalition troops. Some in the Iraqi military have pretended to surrender, then opened fire on coalition forces that showed them mercy. Given the nature of this regime, we expect such war crimes, but we will not excuse them. War criminals will be hunted relentlessly and judged severely. In the last week, the world has also seen the nature of the young men and women who fight on our behalf. They are showing kindness and respect to the Iraqi people. They are going to extraordinary lengths to spare the lives of the innocent. Our forces are delivering food and water to grateful Iraqi citizens in Safwan and Umm Qasr. The contrast could not be greater between the honorable conduct of our liberating force and the criminal acts of the enemy. Every atrocity has confirmed the justice and urgency of our cause. Against this enemy, we will accept no outcome but complete and final victory. To meet this objective, we must give our armed services the support and resources they require. I have asked Congress for a nearly $75 billion wartime supplemental appropriations bill. This funding would provide fuel for ships, aircraft, and tanks, supplies for our troops in the theater of operations, and new high-tech munitions to replace the ones we have used in the war. The supplemental would also provide funds to assist in the reconstruction of Iraq and to help protect the American homeland in this time of high alert. I hope the Congress will act quickly to pass this essential measure. The people who serve in the military are giving their best to this country. We have the responsibility to give them our full support as they fight for the liberty of an oppressed people, for the security of the United States, and for the peace of the world. Thank you for listening.
President George W. Bush speaking from Camp David, his Saturday morning weekly radio address. Dan Shore joins us in the studio. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Sure, Scott.
We'll note the president pledged complete victory. He detailed for the U.S. and Britain, he detailed crimes that he said Iraqi forces have committed against Iraqi civilians and U.S. and British soldiers. And Dan, let me turn to you because he also raised the nitty-gritty business of paying for the war. I guess, a supplemental appropriation in Congress.
Well, that's right. It took them some time to give a figure of what they thought that this war would cost. It was under a great deal of pressure from Congress and also from the American people. They said, if you're going to fight a war, what's it going to cost? And eventually the administration came through and they gave a figure of $75 billion. But what that number represents is very hard to conceive of. How long a war were you talking about? Well, it was indicated at one point the premise was a one-month war. Mm-hmm. But these are almost meaningless figures because we don't know what will be lost, how long it will take. And so it becomes the art of politics seems to take over after a while. You want a figure? Here's a figure.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, at the same time, it has been acknowledged in the U.S. and Britain that paying for any kind of post-war reconstruction in Iraq is going to be a considerable expense.
yes, and that becomes a big problem because the question is, what will be the involvement of the United Nations in this? The United States felt that diplomacy failed, and the Bush administration said that was it, and so we're doing this with our allies, 49 of them at last count, as part of this coalition of the willing, and they want to keep this out of the hands of the United Nations. On the other hand, there are some, including British Prime Minister Tony Blair, who have been here saying you can't do that, because if you try to keep the United Nations out, you are inviting a veto from the French and perhaps the Russians for whatever it is that you do want to do. And so they're now trying to find what is the bridge between what they can expect the United Nations to do and don't want the United Nations to do. And there's a line being drawn between relief and rehabilitation on the one hand and reconstruction on the other hand.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about that, not to get ahead of ourselves in advance, but I think it's not inappropriate when we talk about the possible costs, and that bill is, of course, being presented in the week coming up. Some of the European opponents of the war in Iraq, principally France and Germany, have said, of course, that their concern is for the humanitarian efforts and to improve the lot of life in Iraq. So on the one hand, they would seem to be in favor of post-war reconstruction. On the other, they have been openly annoyed by the U.S. and Britain and say that this is essentially their war and we don't want to pay the reconstruction efforts to for their war.
Oh, that's right. And there's certain ambivalence there, and I can understand the ambivalence because there's a lot of ambivalence elsewhere. The point of this is the United Nations has the task, the duty, to try to help these people. At the same time, France, Russia have no intention of ratifying a war that was started without permission of the United Nations. And so as they look at it, to say, look, you wanted this war, you have this war, you couldn't get a resolution supporting the war, you did it anyway, it's your war now. Mm-hmm. Whereas we say, well, yes, it's our war now. Yes, indeed, but there are things the United Nations should do. And I think there's going to be a great deal of difficulty sorting out what is the role under such conditions of the United Nations?
And, of course, there will be a debate in the United States over to what degree U.S. soldiers should be a part of that effort and for what length of time.
That's right. But the debate in the United States is very slow in coming. The latest polls indicate the United States is still very, Americans are still very strongly in support of the war. They remain in support of the war by fairly good majorities, even when you introduce the factor of significant battlefield casualties. They support the idea, for example, as we've mentioned, of cutting back on tax cuts because we have to support the war. I think I've said this several times because I'm so astounded by it, but that in many ways the American public is ahead of its government on this.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, as we listen to President Bush's radio address today, and of course the President of the United States habitually will make a number of appearances in any given week, really in any given day, public pronouncements, but of course now we're speaking at an extraordinary time where everything the president says could conceivably bear on the struggle that is dominating national attention. This president has not undertaken as many opportunities to hold press conferences to address the American
people. Oh, I think on the contrary. I think for the first week or so, the president sort of got off the firing
line. No, I meant before this happened. Previously, before actions began in Iraq, this had been.
That's right. Apparently, at the various times they wanted the president to be out front, and at various other times they preferred that the president not be out front. And it was true that before, as they were getting ready for this war and writing all the plans for it, there was a time in which you didn't hear very much from the president. You heard Secretary of State Powell, an awful lot of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, mm-hmm. at any given time. And then at other times, for tactical reasons perhaps, they decided the president had to come out and say something. yesterday, the radio address today, and all the rest, is the president is back in it after having been out of it a little bit.
And I must inevitably reflect as we're following events this morning. I guess it was a couple of weeks ago Secretary Rumsfeld delivered himself of an offhand comment where if the prospect existed that British forces wouldn't be able to join U.S. forces, he said, well, that's just a strategic plan. We have contingencies if we have to begin the operation without British assistance.
He will not thank you for reminding the public of what he said at that point, which apparently indicated he didn't think it very important to have the British, which, of course, was not what the president was trying to tell Prime Minister Blair at that time. But,
well, not what we've seen by events either.
And the British are playing a very active role right now around Basra and elsewhere.
Yeah, and of course there are Australian forces that are on the ground at the same time and Polish special operation units.
And then, of course, there are Slovenia, Slovakia, and Albania. We should not forget some of the 49 in the coalition of the willing.
Yes, and of course there are surrounding Arab states at the same time who one way or another have made some assets available.
Including now the charge by the United States that Syria has been responsible for transmitting some
assets
Russian materials to Iraq.
Okay. Dan, thanks very much.
Sure.